Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Sunday, the 27th of October, 2013, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. This is episode 61 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality, and we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each show, we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to return to a theme that we dealt with a few years ago here on Reality Check, the subject of our national broadcaster, the ABC, and its promotion of alternative medicine, particularly acupuncture. Is the ABC fulfilling its legal obligation to present an objective and impartial view of the science and provide a diversity of opinions when it comes to acupuncture? Well, that's what we'll try to find out. Then, in our movie review, we'll have a look at three new films: Stranger by the Lake, The Act of Killing, and Gravity. Two of those are going to come with official Reality Check must-see recommendations. So for all that and more, stay tuned here to Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Alright, let's get into our LGBT news roundup covering the time since the last episode of Reality Check back on the 5th of June. So that's covering the last 4.5 months, basically. And let's start, as usual, with marriage news. And let's begin right here in Australia, where finally, just in the last few days, we've had a major breakthrough in the long-running battle for marriage equality over here. Who would have thought? On Tuesday, last Tuesday, October 22nd, there were tears of joy in Canberra as the Legislative Assembly of the Australian Capital Territory passed a bill to introduce marriage equality. The vote was 9-8. With all ALP and Greens members voting in favour and all Liberal Party members voting against. And given that the ACT legislature is unicameral, well, that's it. It doesn't have to go through any upper house. So finally, dear listener, finally, after all these years, Australia is on track to see the first ever same-sex weddings taking place on our shores in early December. Of course, this battle is far from over. The federal government immediately launched a challenge to the constitutionality of the new law in the High Court. And this is where things start to get interesting, because the first hearing in that High Court case is set to take place in mid-December, after the law's already come into effect. Meaning that same-sex weddings will have been going on for about a week or so by the time the court starts hearing the case. And quite possibly dozens, if not hundreds, of couples will have been married by then. Which I think is going to change the dynamic quite a lot, because you'll have legal same-sex weddings taking place literally just outside the doors of the High Court. And it also means our opponents will not only be fighting to rescind marriage equality, but also to annul all those marriages that will have been celebrated by then. That adds a whole new complexion to the debate. It's certainly going to be very interesting to see what happens. Meanwhile, the parliaments of Tasmania and New South Wales are also set to consider marriage equality laws over the next few weeks, so we could even see weddings taking place in those two states as well. Whatever happens, dear listener, the fight for marriage equality in Australia has suddenly regained new momentum and suddenly become very interesting. We're going to see exciting and historic events coming up on our shores over the next few months. Now let's stay in Australia a little bit longer and take a moment to examine another historic shift that's occurred over the last few months when it comes to marriage equality. Because, well, a lot has happened in federal politics since our last episode back in June. First of all, of course, Kevin Rudd came back as Prime Minister. And this time round, he was supportive of marriage equality. So that meant for the first time in history, Australia had a Prime Minister who was in favour of marriage equality. Unfortunately, though, that didn't actually lead to anything because, of course, Kevin Rudd was booted out by the electorate on September 7th. And the consistently homophobic Tony Abbott took over the reins. But I think you can say that at least we've turned a corner now because the new leader of the Labour Party, Bill Shorten, is also in favour of marriage equality, as are numerous members of the Shadow Cabinet. So progress is being made, and I suspect, dear listener, that we've now passed a turning point, and from now on, no future leader of the Labour Party will be opposed to marriage equality. Julia Gillard was the last one, and unfortunately that's going to be part of her legacy, something I suspect she'll live to regret. All right, let's cross the Pacific now to the United States for our other very recent marriage news that's just occurred over the last few days. And let's head specifically to New Jersey, where last Monday, 21st of October, same-sex weddings began taking place. And New Jersey officially became the 14th state in the US to achieve full marriage equality. So congratulations to all our listeners over there in New Jersey. Now, I won't go into all the details of the struggle for same-sex marriage in New Jersey, but long-time listeners to Reality Check will know that it's been going on for years with various ups and downs in the courts and the legislature and blocking tactics by Governor Chris Christie. But finally, it was a court case that brought marriage equality to the state. And just a few days ago, Chris Christie announced that he's not going to appeal that case, meaning that the battle is over. And yet another domino has fallen in the inevitable spread of marriage equality across the United States. New Jersey has a population of 9 million, making it now the third largest state in the US to have marriage equality, after California and New York. Now, did I just mention California? Well, yes, I did, but we haven't discussed that major development, so let's stay in the US a little bit longer and deal with what was probably the biggest marriage news story of the year, which was, of course, the much-anticipated decision of the US Supreme Court on two cases dealing with marriage equality, handed down finally on June 26. Now, the two cases are both quite complicated, and so were the decisions, so let's just look at them in a nutshell. The first case was about DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, and basically the court found that Section 3 of DOMA was unconstitutional. Section 3 had prevented the federal government from recognizing same-sex marriages for the purposes of federal laws and federal benefits. But it doesn't apply now, thankfully, meaning that since June 26th, same-sex couples in the US are officially recognized by the federal government. So a wonderful decision, and one that's already had far-reaching effects throughout the country. For example, same-sex couples in which one member is not a US citizen can now apply for residence in the USA as a couple. And that's just one example of the many injustices rectified by this wonderful decision. Now, the other decision handed down by the Supreme Court on June 26 was also a great win for our side. Not quite as far-reaching as the DOMA decision, but a good result anyway. And this was the case on California's Proposition 8. Prop 8 was the ballot initiative approved by the voters in 2008 to take away the right for same-sex couples to marry. Now, this case had been going through the courts for years, and we've pretty much followed the whole sequence of events here on Reality Check. But to cut to the chase, what the court found was that the proponents of Prop 8 did not have standing to appeal the case. So actually, they shouldn't have been allowed to appeal the original 2010 trial court decision. So basically, the court said, oops, it's all been a big misunderstanding. Let's forget everything that's happened since then, and let's go back to that 2010 decision, which found that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional, meaning, finally, that marriage equality must be restored in California. And indeed, it was. On the 28th of June, same-sex weddings began once again across California. So, another wonderful victory. And that meant that California became the 13th state to achieve marriage equality. Well, actually, originally, California was the second state to get marriage equality, back when it got it the first time round in 2008, but now, 5 years later, when it gets it back, it's become the 13th. Interesting how these things turn out, isn't it? So these two Supreme Court decisions have certainly lit a fire under the marriage equality cause in the US, and things are really taking off all over the country. Over these last few months, we've seen major developments in New Mexico, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Illinois, Oregon, Ohio, Colorado, Michigan, and Hawaii, just to name a few. In New Mexico, some county clerks have even begun emitting marriage certificates, and dozens of couples have got married. Are they valid? I don't know. The courts will decide. One thing is certain, though, dear listener, you'll see much more action over the coming months, and you'll see more and more states achieving marriage equality. Whatever does happen, you know that you can be sure you'll be kept well informed of all major developments right here on Reality Check. Now, for the other big marriage news that's happened over the last few months, let's cross the Atlantic and head to the British Isles, where England and Wales both achieved full marriage equality in July. The Marriage Equality Bill went through the House of Lords on July 15th, back to the House of Commons on July 16th, and finally, the following day, July 17th, it received the royal assent from Queen Elizabeth II, meaning that marriage equality is now law in England and Wales. It should come into force sometime early in the new year. So an incredibly exciting development there, and one that was pretty much unthinkable just a few years ago. Now, as we've mentioned before here on Reality Check, marriage is actually a devolved issue in the UK, meaning that England and Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland all have different laws on the issue. Scotland is already well advanced with its plans. A marriage equality bill was introduced into the Parliament there in June, and it's expected to be passed in early 2014. Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, however, there seems to be very little progress at all. It looks like it's going to be a long time yet before we see same-sex weddings over there, unfortunately. So, England and Wales together, with a combined population of 57 million people, now becomes the third largest jurisdiction in the world to have achieved marriage equality, after Brazil and France. So, not an insignificant development at all. And speaking of countries and populations, let me take a moment, dear listener, to give you an interesting little statistic. You see, as part of the group I'm involved with, Melbourne Port's Residents for Marriage Equality, we prepared a little infographic calculating the entire global population now living in jurisdictions with marriage equality. As of July 1st, when we released the infographic, that figure was 607 million people worldwide. Now, with England and Wales and New Jersey joining the club, and of course the 400,000 inhabitants of the ACT, that figure has risen to 673 million people. And of course it will surely rise in the coming months. So now no one can argue that marriage equality is going to go away, that it's just a passing fad in a handful of crazy left-leaning countries. 673 million people would seem to indicate otherwise. Marriage equality is in fact a permanent and irrevocable human rights advance, and one that is gradually sweeping the entire world. So now for our final marriage story, let's head to South America to have a quick look at the complicated situation in Colombia at the moment. Now, dear listener, you may remember that back in July 2011, the Constitutional Court of Colombia ruled, and I quote, that same-sex couples must have the same right to legal recognition as opposite-sex couples, unquote. And the court said that if Congress hadn't legislated to allow this by 20th of June 2013, then that right would come into force automatically. So, that June 20th deadline has now come and gone, and did the Congress get its act together and legislate for same-sex recognition before the deadline? No, of course it didn't. It just dithered. The Colombian Senate, in fact, rejected a same-sex marriage bill in April, meaning that the deadline came and went with no legislative action, meaning that supposedly same-sex couples in Colombia now have the same right to solemnize their relationship as opposite-sex couples do. But does that mean civil marriage? Or something else? Well, that's the $64,000 question, and no one is quite sure of the answer. So what's happened since that deadline passed on June 20th? Well, couples have been going to registry offices and getting quote-unquote solemn union contracts, which are not exactly marriages, but no one's really known what to do. It's all been very confusing. Then in September, two couples were actually issued with civil marriage licenses by two judges. Unfortunately then, in early October, one of those marriages was annulled by another judge. But then, just last Thursday, a different judge overturned the annulment, meaning that the marriage is valid again. It's all incredibly confusing. So it seems the issue is almost certainly going back to the Constitutional Court to give the judges the chance to explain exactly what they meant 2 years ago. So fingers crossed, dear listener, that this confusion is all resolved quickly and resolved in favour of marriage equality in Colombia. Whatever happens, you can be sure that you'll hear about it right here on Reality Check. Now that's all our marriage news for today. Let's just quickly update you on one more news item before concluding our LGBT news roundup. And let's return once again to Australia, where I have another exciting piece of good news. Now, as we reported in our last episode, legislation to outlaw discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity here in Australia was passed by the House of Reps back in May, as an amendment to the Sex Discrimination Act. Well, I'm delighted to report, dear listener, that it was also passed by the Senate in late June and came into force on August 1st. So finally, it is now illegal in Australia to discriminate against someone on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity. And also, interestingly, on the basis of their intersex status. In fact, Australia has become the first country in the world to outlaw discrimination on the basis of intersex status. That's extraordinary. We're so advanced in some things we do, yet so backward in others. Anyway, it's great news at last. And of course, this is an issue that we've been following for many years here on Reality Check, and it's finally come to pass. That's really the last main LGBT legal reform that we needed to achieve at the federal level, apart from, obviously, marriage. So we're almost there. We've almost achieved full legal equality. Just one major step to go, at least at the federal level. So that brings us to the end of our LGBT news roundup for the last 4.5 months. Let's take a quick break now and listen to a song. And when we come back, we'll have a look at how the ABC has been going when it comes to objective and unbiased reporting on acupuncture. Well, I can tell you now, dear listener, it's not very impressive. Not very impressive at all. So don't go away. Much more reality check coming up here on Joy 94.9.
Bringing a little joy to your life. Joy
94.9. Para calmar mi ansia, yo te quería llamar, pero no tenía tu número.
Joy 94.9, radio that's out and proud. Joy!
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Obsesión by Dominican-American bachata group Aventura. We now move into the part of the show where we undertake a skeptical analysis of a subject related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. And today we're going to revisit an issue that we've looked at once before here on Reality Check. Back in episode 11, actually, in October 2009. So that's exactly 4 years ago. And the topic we're returning to is the issue of acupuncture, and particularly the pro-acupuncture bias of our national broadcaster, the ABC. So what's changed in those 4 years after our withering critique of the ABC's complete lack of balance when it comes to acupuncture back in 2009? Have they sent all their staff off for retraining to make sure they report the facts clearly, objectively, and without bias? Well, unfortunately, that doesn't appear to be the case. Now, I decided to talk about this issue today on Reality Check because I recently went through a formal complaints procedure on this exact issue. First with the ABC itself and then with ACMA, the regulator. My complaint stemmed from a report broadcast on the ABC radio show AM in September last year about a new acupuncture study which supposedly proved that acupuncture works. At least that's the impression you would have got by listening to AM. Now, this is a large and complex topic and there's a lot to talk about, but I don't want to get too bogged down in all the details. I'm going to try to condense everything down to the basic points. So what I want to do today basically is first talk briefly about the main problems with acupuncture research. Then we'll listen to the ABC report on acupuncture to see how they covered the topic. Then we'll talk about some of the major problems with that specific study in question that was the subject of the segment. And then I'll briefly talk about how my complaint process went. And finally, we'll suggest ways that the ABC could possibly deal with these issues in the future. So without further ado, let's get into the first part. The three main problems with acupuncture research. And problems that any reporter should have in mind when reporting on acupuncture and research related to it. Now, acupuncture is a quote-unquote therapy originating in traditional Chinese medicine. In other words, it comes from a pre-scientific era. It is not based in science, but in dogma. And that dogma basically says that you can cure disease by clearing blockages in the flow of qi throughout the body. And apparently, qi flows along specific paths known as meridians. And to clear these blockages, you need to insert needles into the skin at specific points. Now, there are several huge problems with acupuncture. Let's just look at the three main ones. First, qi, this supposed life force, energy flowing through the body, has never been detected or measured or shown to exist in any way. The same with meridians. Science has never been able to detect them. So I think we can safely say that qi does not exist, nor do meridians. So that's the first massive problem with acupuncture. The second huge problem is that even though acupuncture is based on inserting needles at specific points along the meridians, study after study has shown that actually it doesn't matter where you put the needles. You still get the same effect. And it doesn't even matter if you use needles or not. You get the same effect from twirling a toothpick on top of the skin. So, if it doesn't matter where you do it on the body, or even how you do it, then any effect that you observe is probably not based on acupuncture. It's probably just a placebo effect, resulting purely from the patient believing that they're receiving an effective treatment, and not from any real, actual effect that the treatment is having. And finally, the third huge problem with acupuncture is that it's very difficult to study because it's very hard to do double-blinded clinical trials. That is, trials in which neither the patient nor the practitioner knows if the patient is receiving the real treatment or just a sham placebo. Now, some researchers have tried to develop ways around this by using sheathed needles. But generally, this problem makes the vast majority of acupuncture trials highly open to bias and of poor or suspect quality. So those are just three massive problems with acupuncture and acupuncture research. There are many others, but let's just stick with those three for the time being. So in the light of all this, how should we react when a researcher comes along publishing a paper saying, oh, look at my research, I've shown that acupuncture works? Well, that's quite an extraordinary claim, and it should be approached with great skepticism. Extraordinary claims, after all, require extraordinary evidence. And in September 2012, one group of researchers did claim to have evidence that acupuncture works. And the ABC radio program, AM, reported on that supposed evidence. Let's listen now to that entire report. It goes for about 3.5 minutes. This is the segment broadcast on ABC Radio's Morning Current Affairs show, AM, on September 11th, 2012. And while you're listening, try to get a rough estimate of how much time during the interview is given to the researcher, Andrew Vickers, and how much time is devoted to the actual reporter who's asking the questions. Just try to get a rough idea of the proportion.
Acupuncture has been used to treat pain for thousands of years, but up until now there's been a lack of scientific evidence pointing to its efficacy. Now researchers in the US have completed a study involving thousands of patients that shows acupuncture does provide some clinically relevant pain relief. The work is published today in the journal Archives of Internal Medicine. Reporter David Mark spoke to the paper's author, Dr. Andrew J. Vickers, from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York.
One of the things about acupuncture is, you know, a lot of clinical trials that have been done, and one study comes out and it's positive and the next one comes out and it's negative, and you read the stories in the paper from day to day, you're not really quite sure what to believe. What most health researchers say is important is to look at all of the trials together. Let's look at the big picture rather than individual trials. What we did that was different is we only included the very highest quality trials, and we also did what was called an individual patient data meta-analysis. Instead of just trusting the numbers that have been published in the scientific paper describing the trial, what we did is contacted the authors and obtained the raw data and then did all the reanalyses ourselves.
And what did you find?
I think most people would be uncomfortable if doctors started referring patients to treatments that were just a placebo. So there is this very important question, is acupuncture just a placebo? And there we have the trials where you're comparing acupuncture to sham acupuncture, and we found highly significant differences between true acupuncture and sham. Our data suggests very strongly that the effects of acupuncture go over and above those of placebo. And the effects were actually quite large. They were certainly of the order of magnitude that most people say, well, you know, this is certainly worth doing, especially given that acupuncture is associated with relatively few side effects.
Were you able to quantify the quality of the pain relief?
What we report in the paper is we imagine the following situation, that there's a group of patients who've had chronic pain for a while, and they're either treated by acupuncture or not, and then they're asked 3 or 6 months later, have you had an important improvement in your pain? Has it made a real difference to your life? And what the effects that we found were equivalent to would be that if patients didn't have any acupuncture at all, about 30% would say, yes, my life has really improved. If they had sham acupuncture, about 42.5% would say that they'd experienced an important improvement in pain. If they received real acupuncture, then about half of them would say that it made a big difference to the level of pain they experienced. So a large difference between true acupuncture and no acupuncture at all, a smaller difference between true and sham acupuncture, but one that is certainly statistically significant.
There are going to be many people listening to this in Australia who have chronic pain. Would you have a message for these people now if they are considering acupuncture or if they're in fact already using acupuncture?
For a patient who is interested in acupuncture or considering it as one of the options to manage a chronic pain condition that is not being well treated by whatever it is they're currently doing, whether that's medication or physical therapy, this is something they can now discuss with the doctor and use our study as providing good evidence that acupuncture is actually a reasonable referral option for their condition.
Dr. Andrew Vickers from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, speaking to David Mark.
So there you have it, dear listener, an ABC reporter interviewing a man who's making an extraordinary claim. And he really nailed him down with those tough, probing questions, didn't he? Yeah, not so much. And just in case you're wondering, I used a stopwatch to work out how much time the interviewer spoke and how much time the interviewee, and Andrew Vickers was allowed to speak for 92% of the interview time. In other words, he gave his perspective for 92% of the interview. But of course, the point is that you'd have no idea, if you were just a regular listener to AM, what an extraordinary claim Andrew Vickers is making, and just how problematic the field of acupuncture research is. And you'd have no idea how problematic that particular meta-analysis that he did is as well. Because it turns out that the study that Andrew Vickers and his colleagues published, that meta-analysis, is riddled with problems, as many skeptics and other medical researchers have pointed out. For example, the Vickers meta-analysis included the results from 29 clinical trials. Now, as he said in the interview, we only included the very highest quality trials. Oh, really? So all those trials were double-blinded, were they? Well, as it turns out, no, they weren't. The authors of the study of the meta-analysis even state, and I quote, "While we considered the risk of bias of unblinding low in most studies comparing acupuncture and sham acupuncture, healthcare providers obviously were aware of the treatment provided, and, as such, a certain degree of bias of our effect estimate for specific effects cannot be entirely ruled out." End quote. Well, that would seem to be an understatement. Bias cannot be entirely ruled out. You think so? So the trials included in the meta-analysis were not double-blinded. The people giving the treatment knew whether they were giving real acupuncture or sham acupuncture. So doesn't that make the meta-analysis, kind of useless? And don't you think this systematic bias might just explain the small 5% difference in pain relief between sham and real acupuncture? Just throwing that out there. Well, Andrew Vickers obviously doesn't, but a lot of other scientists who read the study do. In fact, a lot of the world's best skeptical and science bloggers criticized this particular study on many grounds. Namely, the methodology of the meta-analysis itself, as well as the conclusions that the researchers came to in their discussion. Now, I'm talking about medical professionals and scientists like Stephen Novella, David Gorski, Mark Crislip, Stephen Barrett, Edzard Ernst, Sharon Hill, and the American Council on Science and Health. Some of the world's finest minds when it comes to discerning science from pseudoscience, and for finding problems with these kinds of studies. Stephen Novella, for example, points out that the authors, in their analysis and discussion, showed a clear pro-acupuncture bias. Other critics pointed out that some of the authors of the study are homeopaths, so not exactly experts on the scientific method, one would think. And all of them have a history of promoting various kinds of alternative medicines and therapies. But perhaps the most problematic aspect of the Vickers study is one that I discovered with just a 30-second search on Google. The meta-analysis was carried out by the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, a well-known cancer hospital. Two of the authors, including Andrew Vickers himself, actually work at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And when you visit the Memorial Sloan Kettering webpage, you can find an article about this latest study, using it to promote the idea that acupuncture is effective for treating chronic pain. And most revealing of all, at the end of that article is a comments section. And to almost every comment, there's a response posted by the hospital. Now, here's an example of one of those comments and the response. The commenter says, "I have chronic osteoarthritis discomfort in most joints. Can you suggest how to find a skilled, well-trained acupuncturist here in Manhattan? Thank you." And the hospital's response is this. "Thank you for your comment. If you would like to make an appointment with one of our acupuncturists, please call our integrative medicine service at 646-888-0800. End quote. In other words, the institute that carried out the meta-analysis promoting acupuncture as a treatment for chronic pain sells acupuncture services as a treatment for chronic pain. It has a financial interest in promoting a belief in the effectiveness of acupuncture. Now, if that's not problematic, dear listener, I don't know what is. And yet, as you heard, dear listener, the ABC report gives no indication of any of this in its segment on AM, which is very disappointing, particularly because the ABC is legally obliged to do so under its code of practice. Within that code of practice, there's a section dealing with impartiality and diversity of perspectives. And that section lists 5 standards of impartiality. The 2 that are relevant to our discussion today are the following. I'll read them. This is from the ABC's code of practice. Present a diversity of perspectives so that, over time, no significant strand of thought or belief within the community is knowingly excluded or disproportionately represented. And do not unduly favor one perspective over another. The ABC's code of practice also describes a hallmark of impartiality as being, quote, a balance that follows the weight of evidence. End quote. So, has the ABC fulfilled its obligations for impartiality when it comes to acupuncture? No, I would say clearly not. Its reporting about acupuncture has, in fact, unduly favoured one perspective over another. And its reporting over time has not presented a diversity of perspectives about acupuncture. An average listener to AM would be left with the impression that science supports the notion that acupuncture is effective, and that this is in fact relatively uncontroversial. When actually, as we know, dear listener, the opposite is in fact true. The ABC is therefore presenting stories that are completely contrary to the facts, contrary to the weight of evidence, and contrary to what it should be doing in its code of practice. And yet, even though I pointed all this out in my complaint to the ABC, my complaint was rejected. Now, I won't go into all the details of my complaint and their response, but in a nutshell, their response was a joke. For example, what about that issue of a diversity of perspectives over time? How did the ABC deal with that? I've never found any evidence of AM or any other show on the ABC broadcasting a segment skeptical of acupuncture. So how did the ABC respond to that particular problem that I pointed out? Well, amazingly, the ABC found that this standard of impartiality had been met. How? Well, they provided evidence of the broadcast of a diversity of perspectives over time when it comes to acupuncture. The evidence they supplied was two reports from AM, one from 2009 and one from 2011, both dealing with the problems of vitamins and herbal supplements. Yes, dear listener, that was their evidence that the ABC has presented a diversity of opinions about acupuncture. Reports about vitamins. Believe it or not, that's the best evidence they could come up with. Actually, no evidence at all for a diversity of perspectives regarding acupuncture. In case you didn't realize it, dear listener, vitamins are not acupuncture. They're different. In another part of their response, so absurd that it's funny, the ABC stated, and I quote, "We do not consider that the perspective of Dr. Vickers was unduly favoured in the context of the report and its focus." End quote. Really? Andrew Vickers' perspective was not unduly favoured? Remember, I used a stopwatch and found that he spoke for 92% of the time in that report. So, let's get this clear. You let Dr. Vickers speak for 92% of the time. You ask him a series of easy softball questions. You include no other opinions at all from anyone, and yet you conclude that his perspective was not unduly favored? Like I said, dear listener, the response from the ABC was a joke. So, because it was so ridiculous, I took my only avenue of recourse, and that was to appeal to ACMA, the Australian Communications and Media Authority that regulates the ABC. And in fact, all other broadcast media in Australia, including us here at Joy 94.9. And as hard to imagine as it is, the response from ACMA was even more of a joke than the response from the ABC. I won't go into details, but basically their response was largely nonsensical. Whoever wrote it clearly didn't understand the original segment broadcast on AM, didn't understand the problems with that segment or with the Vickers study, and didn't really understand the basis of my complaint. They basically just repeated what the ABC had said and then added some points that showed that they had no idea what they were talking about or what the problems were with the Vickers interview. Which is unfortunate because it means that the ABC got away with sloppy journalism that promotes false beliefs. And you know what, dear listener? I think that this is important, that what the ABC broadcasts is important. After all, the ABC is the national broadcaster. And this was not some trashy current affairs show on a commercial channel. This is AM, the flagship national current affairs radio show, the most prestigious and highly regarded in the country, the one that sets the agenda every day, the one that the politicians and judges and journalists and people with power and influence listen to every morning. So it is of concern that even at that highest level of broadcast journalism, acupuncture gets a totally free ride. It's of concern because influential people hear that message and believe it. And ultimately, it's of concern because belief in the effectiveness of alternative therapies like acupuncture is dangerous. If people believe that acupuncture is effective, they may use it to actually try to treat a serious illness. They may delay other life-saving, science-based treatments. So what should that ABC journalist have done? And what should the ABC do from now on? Well, here's where we try to offer some constructive criticism. I would suggest that ABC journalists, in fact all journalists, take a variation of the Bayesian approach when it comes to reporting science. Now, what do I mean? Well, let me explain. To put it in a nutshell, I mean considering scientific claims on the basis of prior probability. When you're evaluating a claim, or a study, or a set of data, you don't come to it in isolation. You come to it in the light of everything we already know about the science, physics, chemistry, and the particular subject at hand. So then the question to the researcher becomes not, did you get a result that was statistically significant? But what would this particular research have to have shown in order to overturn everything that we've previously learnt about this subject? So when some researcher comes along and says, look, I did a meta-analysis and I found a difference of 5% between real acupuncture and sham acupuncture, and my number crunching shows that this is statistically significant. Don't just say, oh, it's statistically significant. Okay, I'll report on that. That sounds good. No, what you should say as a journalist is, hang on, let's look at this in the light of everything we know about qi, about the difficulty of studying acupuncture, about the general quality of acupuncture studies, about what all other quality acupuncture research has shown until now, and about the inherent problems and biases associated with meta-analyses, because they're problematic in themselves. So taking all that into consideration, the question to ask then is, what kind of a result would this researcher have to come up with to show that acupuncture has a real effect and not just a placebo effect? Does this 5% difference they found between the two groups actually represent a real effect? Or is it just part of the noise coming from the systematic bias in the studies that they used? And then the journalist should ask tough questions coming from this perspective. Because the problem is this, there will always be people like Andrew Vickers and his fellow authors who publish biased studies purporting to support their particular favoured medical therapy, whatever that happens to be. And those studies will always somehow manage to get published in reputable journals. But what shouldn't happen is that quality sources of news and current affairs should not just report on those biased studies as if they were just straightforward science news. They need to report on them with a skeptical and informed approach, asking critical questions and bringing in skeptical and dissenting voices. When institutions like the ABC don't do that, it not only damages the standing of that institution, but worst of all, it promotes false beliefs in the community. It misinforms the public on issues related to their health. And the consequences of that could potentially be disastrous. Now, before we go to a song, if you'd like to send in your opinions or a comment or question on today's topic or an idea for a future topic, please send us an email. The address is realitychecktony, that's T-O-N-Y, at gmail.com. You can also visit our webpage too for past episodes of Reality Check. That's at realitycheckonline.net. Now let's take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie reviews.
The world's most uplifting radio station, Joy 94.9.
And I try to spend my time with somebody new, but everyone still reminds me of you. I try to play some songs that change my point of view, but every song still reminds me of you. I dance on walking.
Bringing you more of your community. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The song you just heard there was Still Reminds Me by Indonesian singer Anggun. And we'll have an Indonesian connection coming up in just a moment. It's movie review time here on Reality Check. And the three movies up for review today are Stranger by the Lake, The Act of Killing, and Gravity. Let's begin with the new French film, Stranger by the Lake. Now, this film comes to our shores with quite a reputation, having won the Queer Palm Award at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Stranger by the Lake is set entirely around a beautiful mountain lake at the height of summer. Men come to the lake to swim, sunbake nude, and to go off into the bushes to have sex. It's a nude beach and cruising area all in one. The film follows one young man in particular, Frank, who comes to the lake day after day and gradually becomes infatuated with a hot stud, also a regular at the lake, Michel. Now, I don't want to reveal too much about what happens, but let's just say that Michel is not exactly the nice guy he appears to be. And Frank finds himself drawn into a dangerous and potentially deadly situation. Now, even though this is a small, low-budget film, you really feel like you're in the hands of a very thoughtful director who's meticulously crafted every shot and every sound and every great performance. There's a lot of satisfying attention to detail in this movie. The beautiful lakeside cinematography, the very effective, eerie sound design, it all creates its own unique and unsettling atmosphere that lasts throughout the whole film. It's all quite engrossing, and I have to say, I really enjoyed this movie. And one interesting and refreshing thing to note is that the actors are completely naked for about half their screen time. And it's not gratuitous or titillating, it's just part of the story. They're at a nude beach, or they're having sex, so of course they're naked. And even more refreshing here in Australia is that we even get to see them having actual sex. Yes, dear listener, consenting adults in Australia are finally able to see erections and ejaculations in the cinema. I don't know how this happened, given that our censorship board has such a shameful history of banning anything vaguely sexual. Most recently, I Want Your Love, banned just a few months ago. I don't know, maybe the members of the board have finally understood that allowing adults to see and hear what they want is not going to bring about the downfall of Western civilization. I don't know, but it's certainly heartening to be able to see a film in the cinema with so much uncensored nudity and sexual activity. It's not the best part of the film, but certainly another point that adds to the attraction of this very atmospheric and enjoyable French film. So Stranger by the Lake comes highly recommended by Reality Check. Our second film up for review today is by far the heaviest. In fact, this is one of the grimmest, most shocking, most disturbing documentaries I've ever seen. It's called The Act of Killing, made by an American living in Copenhagen, Joshua Oppenheimer. It's been receiving critical acclaim and awards around the world, and I have to say, I think it deserves it. this film is absolutely extraordinary. I'm calling it a reality check must-see movie. Definitely check it out if you get the chance. Basically, the act of killing is about the large-scale massacre that took place in Indonesia in 1965 and 66, when Suharto came to power. Somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000 so-called communists were massacred by death squads, by militias, by their neighbours. It was something like the Indonesian version of the Rwandan genocide. But the difference between Rwanda, or even Japan and Germany after the Second World War, is that in Indonesia there's been no reckoning with these horrific events, no truth and reconciliation process, no international justice tribunals. Why? Because the people who came to power at that time were Suharto and his cronies and his militias, the ones who ordered and did the killing. And they remained in power for over 30 years. And until today, those murderers are regarded as heroes who saved Indonesia from the communists. And the power structures in place today rely on those same murderous militias to stay in power. Maybe the release of this film will, in fact, mark the beginning of a certain kind of reckoning with what happened. One can only hope so. Now, I need to warn you, dear listener, this film is long, over 2.5 hours long, and I think too long, because the subject matter is so harrowing, you really can only deal with a certain amount of this material at any one time. But basically, there are two strands running throughout the documentary. On the one hand, we follow the story of Anwar Kongo, one of the gangsters from Sumatra, who killed about 1,000 suspected communists in his town, mostly by strangling them with wire. The film's director helps Anwar to make his own kind of film within a film, recreating many of the ways in which he killed his victims. This, as you can imagine, is riveting and harrowing to watch. But the other strand running through the film is just as riveting and often even more shocking. And this is about how power functions in Indonesia today. This is where you see how the politicians depend on militias and gangs of thugs to blackmail, threaten, torture, and kill anyone who stands in their way. And they talk about it openly. The impression of Indonesian society that this film creates is one of pure corruption and hopelessness. And frankly, I found that somehow even more depressing than the story of the mass killings. The things that the director was able to capture politicians and businessmen and militia leaders and gangsters saying on camera are just mind-blowing. Every 5 minutes in this movie comes another completely shocking revelation captured on film that you just can't believe you're witnessing. That's why I describe this film as extraordinary and a must-see movie. See it if you get the chance, but with one proviso. Make sure you're in the right mood, because this is definitely not a film for the faint-hearted. Now, finally, on a lighter note, let's talk about Gravity. Well, lighter in the sense that this is a fun Hollywood thrill ride. Even though, of course, it does deal with life and death and is extremely tense throughout, but tense in a fun Hollywood way. And this high-stakes tension has obviously struck a nerve among audiences because this film has been a stunning success. And rightly so, in my opinion. It's been incredibly popular with the critics, 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, 96% on Metacritic, and it's already been a huge box office success, over $300 million worldwide so far, and it's only been out 3 weeks, and hasn't even opened in China, Japan, the UK, or a lot of Europe, so it's going to be hugely successful when it finally does. In fact, I would say that Gravity is one of the most important films of the year. And for that reason, it's another official reality check must-see movie. And when you go to see Gravity, make sure you see it in 3D. I think it really adds something special seeing the astronauts up here close to you and the Earth way down there below. Now, I don't think the movie is particularly profound. It won't change your life, but it really is quite a breathtaking spectacle, the likes of which we've almost never seen before in the cinema. In the same way that The Matrix was a small revolution in cinema back in 1999 with its whole style and special effects, I think Gravity also represents a small revolution in the capacity for filmmakers to really create amazing spectacles with CGI and 3D effects in ways they've never really been done before. Having said all that, it's far from a perfect movie. There are some things that annoyed me. For example, there seemed to be a couple of allusions to God and religion, which were quite on the nose. And without giving away any plot points, at one of the dramatic high points, about halfway through the movie, the physics involving tether cords doesn't seem to me to be quite accurate, and that threw me out of the drama for a moment. And the whole story is, of course, ridiculously contrived, but that's where the good old suspension of disbelief comes in, so that didn't bother me too much. But for just a pure, gripping, high-adrenaline, 90-minute spectacular thrill ride, I think this movie does that as well as pretty much any other film ever, and even breaks new ground in doing so. That's why it's an official reality check must-see movie. So there you have it, dear listener, Stranger by the Lake, The Act of Killing, and Gravity. Three extremely different movies, but all highly recommended by Reality Check. Check them out if you get the chance. Now, just before we end the show, I should mention that I already know that this is going to be our last episode for 2013, because I'm off to Mexico next week for almost 3 months, and I won't be back until late January. So have a great new year and holiday season, and I'll talk to you when Reality Check returns in 2014. That brings us to the end of the 61st episode of Reality Check. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website to subscribe to the podcast. That's at realitycheckonline.net. Have a great week, everyone, and I'll be back with the next episode sometime in early 2014. See you then.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.